The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 375 for Tuesday, January 17th, 2012.
Good greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips. We provide some tips of our own, and together we all try to learn at least one new thing each episode. Here, back in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Just one?
Wow.
At least one.
That's setting the bar very, very low.
All right, so we're trying to learn 10 new things. We'll do it order of magnitude. So if it's not one, it's 10.
Excellent. That's right. Much better. And here, in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Hi, John. How are you?
Great. You know, I was freaking out this morning. I thought people were throwing things in my house.
Did you have hail coming down?
Sleet and various solid type precipitation, which eventually melted all away. And
That's too bad. So that means you didn't notice when me and the other listeners were out throwing rocks at your windows?
Well, now I'm tuned to it. But yeah, it woke me up early. Well, we still had people playing bumper cars.
Yeah, well,
you would think, well, due to the lack of any sort of, you know, real wintry weather, at least in my neck of the woods here, you know, it's almost like people in some of the southern states, you know, when they get ice and snow, it's just it's a disaster. I think you saw this when you were in Texas, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You stay home when there's ice in Texas. I learned that people, man, hitting their brakes on bridges and stuff. It's like, dude, it's not their fault in that they're just not used to it. All right, but this is not the driving geek gab, but it could be your highway vigilante here in Durham, New Hampshire, Dave Hamilton. So it was interesting. I had a conversation last week with Mac Geek Gab Jim, and then actually it flowed into a conversation with John Martellaro, and we'll talk about both of them. But I mentioned to MGG Jim that during the conversation, I said, okay, well, when we hang up, I'm going to sign off Skype. I've got to restart because new apps that I've been launching all day aren't showing up in my dock, and nothing is showing up in my task switcher when I hit command tab. And Jim said, try kill all dock. And so I did. I went to the terminal and I typed kill all space dock, and with a capital D being the only capital character in that whole string. And that kills off your dock, which then forces it to respawn. And sure enough, when the dock came back up, that fixed both the dock and the task switcher. So a handy little tip. You can kill it from within the activity monitor. There's many ways to kill off the dock. It will always attempt to come back. Yep. So
now, was this on a Lion machine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. You know, that's very interesting because I got to say my experience so far with Lion has been very positive, and that my major gripes with Snow Leopard is that when there were app updates, they would not appear in the App Store icon. And for Lion, I find it very consistently does it correctly.
Interesting.
And the other thing, which was my second gripe in the dock, is that iCal, not that it's the end of the world, but the date would not change. And I've noticed almost like as soon as the date changes, it will change.
And third-party apps like BusyCal also with Lion have the ability to update their dock icons like that. So, yeah, the whole API changed for that stuff. But, yeah, I mean, I was launching apps and like FileMaker. I vividly remember this day. I had to keep trying to relaunch FileMaker from within the Finder only to get its window to come up, even though it was already launched. It would not show up in the dock. It was bizarre. But
and you know what? I just looked this up here because, you know, I was scratching my head when you said kill all, Dave, because there's another terminal command called kill. And so, well, I just answered the question, but to share with the listeners. So we'll, you know, we'll count this as thing number one learned today or two. We won't keep track. But whereas kill, I believe the argument for that is a PID or process ID, which sometimes is not immediately apparent.
Right.
That it never is, maybe if you look in activity monitor, but kill all, as far as I can tell here. So how did I find this out? Well, I went into the terminal, I said man, which brings up a manual page, space, kill all. And apparently that will kill it by name. So there's kill and kill all.
Right.
The difference, so I suppose if you knew the PID of the doc process, you could say kill and then
that's
PID,
right.
But that's a pain in the neck.
It's a pain in the neck. Now, the only the only downside to kill all is if you happen to have multiple instances of the same binary running, like if somehow I had multiple instances of doc that were assigned to my user account. Now, other users' accounts, other users' instances of doc would not be affected by me typing simply kill all space doc. But that is the risk. If you've got, and I can't, maybe you're doing some encodings or something, you know, it would be a pretty odd situation where you'd have multiple instances of the same app in a standard computer usage environment. But that is the issue. For example, on our web server, if I want to shut down Apache, the right way to do it is to send a kill signal to the parent process. Doing kill all Apache 2 or HTTPD or, you know, whatever the process is called, will just kill everything kind of in an unceremonious way, which sometimes is necessary. But anyway, I digress. So John, that conversation led into another conversation with John Martellaro, who was having trouble. Let's see, let me get this right. He could not hear us on Skype when his headphones were plugged in. But as soon as he unplugged his headphones and then, of course, reverted to his speakers, it worked fine and he could hear us. So we had our conversation, you know, we had our daily staff meeting. But then afterwards, he's like, gosh, you know, I wonder if my headphones are bad or this, that, and the other thing. And so I said, okay, well, go ahead into system preferences and check your volume levels. And now volumes were good and all of that. And I said, well, you know, maybe I know Skype has, especially with version 2.x, of course, he was on 5.x. But I remember with version 2.x, Skype having some issues with the sample rate. And so I said, OK, open Audio MIDI Setup, which is an application inside everyone's utilities folder, which is inside your applications folder. And I said, check your built in output and see what the format is, because that's going to tell you what the sample rate is. And so for internal speakers, it was 44.1 kilohertz. And then he plugged in his headphones and it was still 44.1. And then he unplugged them and, you know, we were back on speakers. I said, okay, now below that in Audio MIDI Setup, check the, there are volume sliders for the left and right channels, channel one being left, channel two being right. And then to the right of those is a little checkbox that is labeled mute. And so he looked, and when his speakers were in, the volume was up and the mute was unchecked. And as soon as he plugged his headphones in, the volume was up, but mute was checked. And it wasn't available anywhere else in the system. It wasn't apparent anywhere else. But obviously, as soon as he unchecked it there, then he was able to hear when he plugged his headphones in. So very, very strange that this worked out this way. He has no idea how it got that way. And of course, my advice to him was, unless it happens again, don't worry about it. Forget it ever happened, because you'll drive yourself crazy trying to figure it out. But yeah, interesting, huh, John?
Crazy.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy stuff, but that's the world we live in. All right. More tips. We got so many good tips today. I don't know why, but they have piled up this week. So, you know, I'm a big fan of Text Expander, John. And then a couple weeks ago, we talked about a little app that Corey Mdyke, I know I'm pronouncing your name wrong, Corey, but we'll hear from Corey later in the show. But he had written that would either manually or automatically strip the formatting out of whatever was on your clipboard. Well, Gene McDonald from Smile said, well, if you've got Text Expander, you can actually make this happen from within Text Expander. And it was David Sparks from the Mac Power Users podcast and MacSparky.com that tipped her to this. And so we'll link to his article. But essentially, all you do is you create a little snippet in Text Expander. You make the contents of it percent clipboard, which means it will fill with whatever's on your clipboard. And you set the content type to plain text. And that works, too. It totally strips it out. So yet another brilliant little tip from the community here. And we love our community. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Group hug. You know, I've noticed this as well, Dave, in several apps that do text processing, they typically have buried somewhere. So, for example, TextEdit will have something that's kind of similar. So you got to paste and you got to paste. paste and match style, which assuming that the style is plain. And then usually, though, I still use Word. Well, I think a lot of people use Word, but Word has an equivalent paste special.
Yep.
And they typically have a list of choices, one of them being unformatted text, which is equivalent. So sometimes, having a utility that handles it for all apps is of course preferable.
Yeah.
For using Text Expander. Otherwise, you got to learn the little idiosyncrasies of each app.
So yep.
Just thought I'd mention those because I've run into that before. It's very frustrating when you paste something and you have triple bold, underline, strike through, backflip, handstand, whatever.
Oh, you know, while we're talking about idiosyncrasies, I know I've mentioned this before, but if you paste something into FileMaker that is formatted text, you can have it unformat that text by, and this is bizarre, by hitting Command Z or choosing Edit Undo. If the text is plain to begin with, hitting Undo once will erase it, will make it as though you didn't paste it in at all. But if the text is formatted, when you paste it in, Command Z once will strip its formatting and make it go as plain text. Command Z again will pull it out completely. So it's I don't know if that's documented anywhere, so I throw it out. I know we've talked about it, but it's a good reminder for all of us that use FileMaker. All right. Dave has a tip. He said recently you mentioned a terminal command for permanently presenting resume, which can be done either globally or on a per app basis from within Lion. Now, of course, for resume, what he's talking about is when you relaunch an app and it reopens all of its windows the same way you had it in the past. Dave says, as I suspect you also know, you can prevent it on the next launch by holding down Alt or Option when you quit the app. But what I've found many people don't know is that if you hold down the Shift key when launching an app from the dock, it also does not resume. I leave resume enabled, but use the Alt Option and or Shift techniques when I want. So there you go. That's yet another good resume tip.
Don't trip on your tip.
I know. All right. Well, we might as well just keep blazing along here. These are good tips.
Go, brother.
Okay. And I will paraphrase here. So listener David wrote in and he said that he was having a problem. He had called AppleCare and the AppleCare supervisor basically said, so sorry, but, we can't help you anymore, or we can't help you with this problem. Either you're just out of warranty. I forget exactly what the circumstance was, but he was either just out of warranty or it was something that was on the fence as to whether it was something AppleCare would cover or not. And the AppleCare rep said, no, so sorry. Wish I could help, but I can't. And so he asked our advice and I said, my thought was, well, that your last ditch effort is to call not AppleCare or not customer support, but what they call the customer relations department. And you get to that at Apple by calling 408-996-1010, which is the main switchboard number at Apple, and ask for customer relations. When you're doing this, it helps if you've already got a case opened within AppleCare and if you've tried multiple times to get things solved with AppleCare. And then you call up and you give them your case number. And these are, as I've called them before, these are the customer service ninjas. They are there to make you happy as long as within reason. And so he did. He called them up and he said they approved the repair and they're going to fix it for him and he's good to go. So your mileage will vary. They are not just total pushovers over there, but they are the people that have the authority and ability to kind of sit back and look at the whole picture. And even if it's not something that's officially covered, they're the ones that can make an exception happen. And oftentimes they do, if it's the kind of thing that, I think they kind of apply what I would call the reasonable man's case. They sort of take a step back, look at the whole thing and say, yeah, you're right. Go ahead and let's do this. Or no, you know what? We've done everything that we can and sorry, go ahead and move on. So customer relations at the main Apple switchboard is the last ditch effort, if you will. And I think John, you and I have both had excellent experience actually with customer relations. So that's a good thing.
I don't think I've ever dealt with them. Actually, I think that the last time I had a long drawn out problem, it was the AppleCare people.
It was.
I should have flipped it. No, it was, I think you remember, it was my old.
Yeah, you got a machine replaced, I remember.
Well, I had six back and forths with.
Too many.
Well, the thing is, yeah, I had a problem, and every time I sent it to him and I got it back, the machine was losing functionality. And at one point we were at number six, and, you know, I just said to the guy, I mean, just, you know, in a very nice, reasonable manner, I said, you know, you're losing money every second you talk to me, and my machine is still not working. And I think that, you know, last time I talked to him, I said, you know, if we go through one more exchange, then, you know, you really, I almost think you're obligated to give me a new machine because you keep breaking it every time I send it to you.
Yeah.
And the guy couldn't argue with that, though, and, you know, there should be a cutoff, though, because
there is, it's actually three. So if it goes back and forth three times, and after the third time, it's still not repaired. And this can be, someone will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it can be the same machine for three different things. So if you have three problems fixed with the machine and then there's a fourth, or if you have the same problem attempted three times and then after that it still remains. So essentially three repairs and something else wrong with it. At that point, calling customer relations is the right move, because in most cases they'll swap it out and send you one. That's my understanding.
Okay, this was in the age of a PowerBook, so this was a number of years ago. Yeah. So it sounds like they probably, well, just for everybody's sake, to save time and money, they updated the policy.
That's been the policy for decades. But you have to call customer relations to get it.
I see.
AppleCare is not going to offer it up necessarily. They may, and in your case, obviously they did, but
eventually,
yeah.
But again, as I've stressed to him, you know, you've just lost money on this AppleCare contract.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that.
That's right.
I mean, just the shipping alone, because they would do overnight, you know, airborne when they existed. And doing that six times, I'm sure, cost way more than or about as much as the AppleCare contract. So.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Sure. What else we got?
All right. Charles has an interesting thing he stumbled on. He says, "Hi, John and Dave. Having just spent a fingernail chewing 4 hours on a Sunday morning thinking I had converted my MacBook Pro i7 with twin SSD and 750 gig hard drive into a very expensive paperweight, I thought I'd share this tip. I needed to do a clean install of Lion for reasons I won't go into, but let's say Windows 7 was involved. When I tried to do this from the recovery partition, it failed with the error saying, there was a problem installing Mac OS X, try reinstalling. So I plugged in my external DVD drive and used my disk image. Same error. Finally wrote a USB stick with the disk image, and you guessed it, same error. At this point, panic was beginning to set in. I searched on Google and fortunately found the answer. Reset the PRAM, restart the install, and all is okay. Just a few more gray hairs. It seems that some part of the old Lion installation is left in the PRAM, which stops the clean install. This is not the best way to spend 4 hours on a Sunday, but having found the answer, I thought it might be worth sharing to avoid others having the same problem. Charles, you are a man among men. Thank you for taking the time to share this with all of us and save us the 4 hours on a Saturday morning. A Sunday morning. Sorry. That's very interesting. I would love to know. Clearly it worked for Charles, and it seems like based on his Google searching, it worked for many other people. But I'd be curious to know what that is that gets stuck in the PRAM. Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating stuff, though. I don't know. I don't have the magic answer, John. What I do have is a set of A5 speakers from Audio Engine, and they are our first sponsor for this show. AudioEngineUSA.com. They make a lot of different speakers. They make the A5s, which I have here on my desk. These are about 8 inches tall, 6 inches deep. There's two speakers, two enclosures, and then two speakers inside each enclosure. And these things sound fantastic. It's sort of a waste that I have them up here in the studio. I mean, they sound great for, especially if I'm ever mixing music or anything. And they certainly are good for that. But for the most part, I'm just kind of previewing the podcast with them, and they could fill a room much, much larger than this studio with sound. But they do sound good, and I'm happy to have them here. It's interesting with these A5s. They've got a power port on the back, which allows them to power, say, an Airport Express. Right. So you could plug in an Airport Express into the back of these, both for power and for audio. And then you could stream your music to it. Fantastic sounding speakers. And again, they're good. You know, they call these bookshelf speakers because they sit, you know, they're a fairly large enclosure for a desktop, but certainly not too big for a desktop. And they are $399 a pair at AudioEngineUSA.com. If you want something a little smaller for $199 a pair, you can get the Audio Engine 2s, the A2 speakers. Similar concept in that there's two enclosures, but they're much smaller. And there's two speakers in those, and they too can fill a room much larger than my studio with a really clear, warm sound. You can check them out at AudioEngineUSA.com. They do have a what they call a free 30-day audition, which means if within the first 30 days you decide that they are not for you, you send it back and you get all your money back. And speaking of money, you can save 10% of your purchase price using the coupon code MGGTEN. That's MGG10 for 10% off. All at AudioEngineUSA.com. I guess we're moving on to cool stuff found. Right, John? We've got a couple of things there. You said you've got some stuff and cool stuff found. Why don't you tell us what you found, John?
Well, you know, I'm going to throw out the ones that I was actually working on over the last couple of days here. So
cool.
One, I was hanging out on Twitter today doing various things, and one of my contacts says, "Hey, you know, does this Unix program exist on Mac OS X?" Of course, as most of us know, Mac OS X is Unix based. I think the actual roots are Next Step, which is based on OpenBSD and FreeBSD and all of that. But the cool thing is so you get a nice graphical user interface on Mac OS X, but underneath it all, there is the horror of Unix. But the good thing about Unix is that there is a huge, huge collection of open source software out there. Now, the good news is that there's a lot of it and it's free.
Right.
The bad news is that a lot of times you got to tweak it and tune it, and every version of Unix, and you've went through this too, Dave. I mean, there's so many different versions of Unix and they all have their little idiosyncrasies as far as processor and all that and compilers. So the thing is, even though you may get a Unix package from SourceForge or somebody like that, you may not be able to compile it on your Mac. Now, fortunately, there are not one, not two, but I found there are three groups that will help expose you and get you into the whole open source world if you want to explore a lot of this software. And so we'll, of course, link to it in the lovingly handcrafted show notes. But there are three packages. So the one that I installed today is called Fink. And I'm not going to read the URLs, but I'm going to mention the three of them. So the one here is Fink. And they also have a layer on top of it called Fink Commander. So that's one option here. And actually, I used that today. And actually, the thing that I was just compiling, Dave, just for kicks, once I downloaded Fink and installed it and then used Fink Commander, I installed the X11 version of Emacs, everybody's favorite text editor and the only real text editor for Unix people. And I know, especially, hi, Scott. I know the VI people are going to be shaking their fist. You know, it's funny because in this package, there is no VI. There's Vim, which I guess is a updated version of VI.
Yeah.
Because VI is so incredibly lame. And then there are two.
I don't know this guy here.
No, I like VI as well. VI is great for quick and dirty work, but Emacs is the kitchen sink of editors. And I think there is a kitchen sink.
If we're going to talk about editors, I would say in this day and age, throw both of those out the window and use Nano, N-A-N-O.
Really?
Way less of a memory footprint and a hog than Emacs. Way easier to get around in than VI. It is my choice of editor if I have to use one from the command line. And the benefit is it is installed on every build of Mac OS X. You don't need to compile it at all. N-A-N-O.
Okay. You know, I think there's another one, Pico.
Well, Pico's the old version of Nano.
Okay. Because they're both terms that describe an order of magnitude. Okay. And then the other two that I found, and we'll link to them, and then we'll move on here because I want to go to the second item. So, or we'll go to third-party CSF, and then I'll mention the other one. But the two others are Mac ports, which are... Mac ports, I've heard some people grumble about it, but that's another effort to bring open source software tuned to the Mac And then the third one, which actually someone who was following me and now I'm following them, alerted to me on Twitter. And I think it's probably the new kid on the block, is called Homebrew, which is yet another package manager. So if you want to get a little geeky, the only thing I think for all of these is the condition is that you have to download Xcode, which I understand now is not free. I think you got to buy it for like $5 from the App Store, or if you're in the developer program, you do get it for free. So so you do need Xcode, because I think that installs GCC, which is the compiler that I think all of these use. But not one, not two, but three package managers that will let you check out all these cool free Unix programs.
Cool. All right, let's throw it to David. We've actually got two tips from David. One that he's going to tell us about, and the other that I'll read about. Oh, I think he's going to tell us about it.
Hey guys, my name's David. I just wanted to share a cool extension I found for Gmail. I know you guys prefer mail.app yourselves, but I'm a big fan of Gmail's web interface. Extension for Firefox or Chrome, it's called Boomerang for Gmail. It's at boomeranggmail.com. Basically what this lets you do, I fall into the bad habit of, I use my inbox as my to-do list. I've tried to do the zero inbox thing before and all that stuff, but my problem is I always forget to check my pending folder or action folder. So what Boomerang for Gmail lets you do is, say if there's an email that you can't deal with right now, or maybe you want to be reminded about it in a few days, you just click a button that says remind me in a day, 2 days, whatever. You can set any number of time frames. It will archive that email for you, and then at the specified time frame, it'll bring that message back to the inbox as a new message so you can remember to deal with it. Another thing it lets you do is when you're sending the message, say you're emailing a client a proposal, you can do your typical email, but when you send it, you can click a box that says, bring this back to the inbox if I don't hear back from this person in 2 days or 5 days or whatever. So it's just a nice way to set basically reminders for yourselves to bounce emails back into your inbox. Another cool thing that it lets you do, which is actually what I was searching for, is it lets you type an email to send to somebody and then send it later. So you basically got delayed sending. So I'm in sales. Something that happens commonly for me is I'm doing my stuff at night and typing up a proposal for my client or something, but either I don't want it to hit their inbox late at night, or perhaps the other bad thing is if they get 50 emails overnight, they're not going to see my thing. So instead of sending it immediately, you can click a button that says send later, specify a time, and then Gmail will send that message at that time. So anyways, it's pretty cool. Just thought I'd share that because it's a really good utility for myself. They have a free plan, but it limits you to 10 messages per month, or 10 pending messages, excuse me. Paid plans start at only $5 a month, which I think is really worth it. That gives you unlimited access. So check it out, boomeranggmail.com. If you need to follow up with me, my email.
All right. And we will leave your email out of the show. So the other thing that Dave mentioned, as he said, he's in sales, and he says they use Salesforce, for their CRM stuff. He says one big hurdle most people run into is the bulk of correspondence they will have with clients is via email. And in order to log those emails into Salesforce, it takes several steps. There's a plugin from cirrusinsight.com that shows you what you have going on with a contact right in your native Gmail view. They have a lot of screenshots and videos on the site. So again, it's cirrusinsight.com. We'll put a link out there for that too. And we'll take it from there. So thanks, Dave. That's good stuff. We love things like that. That sounds like a handy little tool. All right. I said we would hear from Corey. Let's hear from Corey. He's got a follow up to.
I got one more.
Oh, go then. Go. Yeah.
One more.
Yeah, absolutely.
So number one, I've noticed this. Actually, I was noticing this today, Dave, and maybe David mentioned this, but I was noticing in Mail App that I do have on the left side of my screen a reminders category that has things that I've flagged. I never noticed this before. I don't know why.
Because it's so foobar the way Mail deals with that stuff, that it's crap.
That's why.
Yeah.
I just noticed it today, and I think maybe it was hidden or something like that. But the other thing I want to mention is so this is something I was actually trying out last night, and I got to say, so we've discussed the whole thing about remote access, and I got to say, so...
Oh, yeah.
So my friend Jody, who is one of our listeners, hi, Jody, and we were talking last night, but she was offering a challenge. She was like, you know what? So she does a Mac and, I guess, computing consulting business, and she was like, you know what? I need... because she lives out in the sticks, and apparently, you know, driving is not hazard, but she'd rather do remote access.
Sure.
Well, as she was like, I'm going to challenge my community here. What is a zero configuration? Now, it's not quite zero configuration, but the thing is, I guess a lot of her customers tend to be not very computer savvy.
Hence the reason that they're customers.
Right.
Which makes perfect sense. Yeah.
So she was like, you know, I need a solution where, you know, even setting up Skype or iChat is probably too complex.
Okay.
I'm like, oh, wow, this is a big challenge. And I think I found it. And actually, we tested this last night. And I got to say, so people have recommended this, but I'm going to give these guys a plug because I think it's probably the best executed remote access solution. And people have mentioned TeamViewer, but I'm just going to cover very quickly what they do that I think is very cool. So not only do they have an app that you install, which a lot of these remote access solutions require you to install an app. And, you know, that's kind of, you know, whether it's ARD or whatever, you got to install software. Well, some people may not be even comfortable or able to install software.
Right.
So here's the thing we finally found. So TeamViewer, they not only have an installer and an application, but they actually have what they call, I think, a quick start version. We'll link to where you can download it. But they actually have a version of their program where all you do is download it, run it. And then what it does is it offers, I think it's an ID and a password. So what's happening behind the scenes is that they're linking to their server farm and registering these IDs. And then what happened is anybody else out on the internet, and again, I verified this with Jody, she's like, okay, here's the ID and password. And I entered it running the application and magically I just had control of her screen.
Wow.
I just got to say, these guys, I think have got it now for non-commercial use. They're free, you know, of course she's a business, but I think also their license is very reasonable, I think, for a one-time fee.
Okay.
So, But I was just shocked. Now, the funny thing was, is she's, because she is in the sticks, she's on a satellite connection. So the thing I noticed is that her screen was actually painting very slowly.
Oh, yeah.
On my screen. I think they're getting DSL. That, yes, this is America, folks, but she's getting DSL in her area. But it was just I just wanted to share it with people.
Cool.
Because it was just the very easiest so far remote access solution that I've used, especially, again, you type in these two values, you're hooked up, you can control the machine. It's cool.
And it's cross-platform, which is huge.
And I also tested out, just for yucks, I tested out the iPhone, and I assume, you know, it would work on the iPad as well. And the same thing, you start up the app, you enter these two, you know, I guess randomly generated numbers after they register with their server. And I was able to connect to my Mac Mini for my iPhone.
Cool.
It's good stuff.
That's great. Yeah, that's good. Cool. All right. Moving into this is still cool stuff found, but in relation to the file sending that we've been discussing in previous shows, Corey has something to add to that.
Greetings, gentlemen. Corey here. I was just listening to Matt GeekGab number 372, and Irv was asking for a service to replace the old MobileMe service, which would upload larger files to a server when you would try to send them in an email. And I've got a replacement for it that'll do exactly what he's looking for. It's called Cloud App, and their website is getcloudapp.com. They've got a handy little menu bar app. You can drag files up there. It'll upload them and then put a link to that file on your clipboard so you can paste it right in. They also have what they call droplets, which is like integrations with other apps. They have one for iPhoto, one for the Finder. They've got a bunch of these, and so it'll add like a cloud app button to those apps, which can be handy depending on your needs. If you want to take it even a step further, he can use Sparrow, which is an excellent mail client in the Mac App Store. It is for pay, but I think it's well worth it. I think it's better than Lion's Mail. But it actually integrates with your cloud app account. So you put in your cloud app username and password once in the preferences, and then from then on out, if you drag a file into the top portion, like the body of a message, instead of attaching it to that message, it will upload it to cloud app for you and put a link in the email, you know, so they can download it. It's all automatic, and it works just like the MobileMe service. It's perfect. Alternatively, if you if you drag a file into the bottom portion of an email message, it'll still attach it the old-fashioned way. So, you know, if it's a small image or something you don't really want to upload, you know, you can still use it in the normal way. Anyway, I think that's exactly what you're looking for. It works really well, and it's even free. So there you go. Cheers.
Thanks, Corey. Awesome. That's it's good to have that follow-up. All right. So we're going to jump to a question because it leads into a tip that's something I did earlier today. Matthew writes, he says, I'm trying to back up some of my movie DVDs and have a problem that is driving me absolutely bonkers. I've tried several programs with the same results, but the one I'm using now is Carbon Copy Cloner. I have it set with the DVD as the source and the destination being a new disk image. Once it starts, it creates the image. But once it starts copying data, it soon fails with the error. Carbon Copy Cloner encountered some errors while accessing files on the source or updating items on the destination. Then it says the error occurred while getting information about this item, and there are 12 entries with the same problem. The console has an error message that talks about privilege violation. The part that drives me crazy is that once in a while it makes the backup with no problem at all. I've succeeded with one disk and then tried the same disk again and it will fail time and time again. So far I've only succeeded with 2 out of 5 disks and many attempts. I also tried with Toast Titanium and it claims the problem is the CSS protection. I would chalk the problem to this and give up, except that I can succeed with Carbon Copy Cloner once in a while. It doesn't bug me so much if it works or fails. It bugs me that it works some of the time and I can't figure out why. Okay, so you're right. It's interesting. Commercially released DVDs are protected with copy protection. It's called CSS, and it's built so that you can't make a copy. Of course, and I'll leave each of you to figure out whether the legalities of your own location. But presumably, if you've got a DVD and you want to make a backup in case the thing scratches, that sounds like a fairly reasonable argument to me. I'm not a lawyer, nor am I a judge. But that sounds like a reasonable argument. So there's a couple of ways to do this. You can use a piece of software called Handbrake. But what's interesting is that Handbrake does not internally have the code to decrypt CSS. In order to get Handbrake to do that, you have to install a piece of software called VLC. Now, VLC is not a movie. It's not a copier, but it's a player. And therefore, it needs to have this CSS code in it, and it does. What Handbrake will do once you've got VLC installed, though, this is a pretty smart thing. VLC is a player, so it's allowed to have the CSS code. Handbrake is a copier, and so it's not allowed to have the CSS code in it. But Handbrake will happily read the code from VLC if you happen to have that on your system, because presumably you know what you're doing. And then Handbrake will rip these movies. But it's important to note, and Matthew, for Matthew's issue specifically, it's important to note Handbrake will make a copy of the movie that's on the DVD, but it won't make a copy of the entire DVD, at least not very easily. You'd have to sort of do that in a manual sense. So you're not going to get all the menus and all that. You're just going to get the movie. There is another piece of software called Ripit from the Little App Factory that it's $25, I think $24.95, that will do many of these things. And one of them is that it will make an entire copy of the entire DVD itself, complete with all the menus and all of that good stuff, if that's what you want to do. So Handbrake, VLC are free. Ripit is not, but it will give you what you're looking to do with Carbon Copy Cloner and cannot. So there you go.
And you know, Dave, a mini rant.
Yeah.
We haven't had a rant for ages or a fish shake, but you know, sometimes I almost see that the media industry is asking for it, especially when I have several DVDs that I've purchased.
Yeah.
And I've seen people talk about this online. I've purchased a DVD. Now, in my mind, I'm entitled to view the content that I paid for. What I'm seeing more and more, and I've seen it on rentals, which I can kind of understand, but I've seen some where now you can't even disable the previews. You can't fast forward through them. You can't skip them. Well, you can fast forward through them, but it's infuriating that you are forced to consume advertising, especially for something that you've paid for. Now, again, the rental, I mean, if you're paying $1 or $1.50 a night, you know, for Redbox or something, okay, maybe I can understand. But
yeah,
but
I think it's subsidizing the cost of the purchase or the rental by forcing you to watch those. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but especially what infuriates me is purchased DVDs that force you to watch ads that you cannot skip. I mean, look, I just paid for this.
You pay full price, right? I mean, isn't it the same thing?
In a lot of cases, yes.
You're not listening. Did you pay the full price? And or is the full price the dollars that you paid plus your willingness to view the ads that they want to show you? So the price is not necessarily just the cash value there.
Just
like the price of the New York Times is not just the price of the paper, but it is the ads that are within it as well. It is a combined package deal.
Yeah, well, then they should offer. So, you know, a lot of movies, yeah. I think, you know, DVD movies are typically under $20, which I think is, you know, probably a good value.
Okay. Yeah.
So maybe this should create another tier. Because right now I don't see this option. They should create another tier, which is the ad-free option.
There you go.
All right, so you pay $30 ad-free, $20 some ads. You rent it from Redbox, and you're a cheapskate—not a cheapskate, but you're looking for value. Yeah. Then you're forced. But right now, I think the industry is kind of lagging as far as offering options that people want.
And that's until they catch up, that's what Handbrake's for. If you don't want to watch, right? I mean, you know, seriously, right? That you could do it that way if you really wanted to.
Rant off, but it's especially now you see the legislation coming up. I think we're going to have a blackout tomorrow on a lot of sites here complaining about some overreaching legislation. But let's move on. We're not the movie, though. Maybe we should be. All right, moving on. What's next?
So we're related to this. We got an email from Darren, and we talked about it last week, John, where he had a problem with his brand new iMac was ripping DVDs with Handbrake very slowly. We talked about this while I was out at CES, I think. It was the week before.
I think we identified the problem in a sense, in that we suspected it was a problem with his
DVD drive. Right. We told him he had a bad DVD drive because that's...
I think he does.
Well, in the end, that may be it, but it's not. It is... His DVD drive is operating exactly as it was intended from the factory. It turns out there is something that has been enabled, if you will, or installed or built in to a lot of newer DVD drives. And it's a technology. I'm not going to give you the name first because the name is a very prejudicial name. It's a technology that what it does is, let's say your DVD drive can go 8 speed, right? 8X. Well, you may not need it going 8X when all you're doing is watching a movie. And in fact, when your drive's going 8X, it sounds like a jet engine is taking off and it's very loud. And that might actually make your movie watching experience less than pleasurable if you've got your computer warring and whining. So they put this this little piece of code in the firmware of these DVD drives that says, hey, when you're watching a movie, slow it down to the speed at which... You know, to the slowest speed that it can go while you're still getting enough data to watch the movie. And that's, in fact, what Darren's drive is doing. And as it turns out, it's the same thing, though I have a slightly different drive from Darren. My iMac was doing the same thing. Now, the problem is that the name of this technology is called RipLock. So, its intention is advertised to be this great thing for consumers. And I don't doubt that it's right. You know, if you had one of these, if you had an iMac in your living room, you'd certainly want it to go slower. And maybe your MacBook Pro on an airplane, if you're watching a DVD, having it go slower potentially makes the battery churn less, you know, so could be helpful. But having it called RipLock kind of makes you think, well, this also is maybe meant to deter people from ripping movies on their iMacs.
Yeah, thank.
Good news, though, John. I found a way, at least on my machine. Now, unfortunately, Darren's drive, it does not seem that this is possible yet. But John, you found a site called I can't remember the name of it. I got to pull it.
So we steered him in the right direction. Now he had found. So I think he came across this technology. So one thing that I'm going to wonder is that we found. So there is an article that talks about this technology on Wikipedia, and it suggests one way to get around it, though they had a question mark or a head scratcher, is to hold down the eject button for a certain amount of time, and it may disable this feature.
Right. But of course, we don't have eject buttons on our DVD drives that are accessible to us.
Well, I'm wondering if you hit the general eject button. But yeah, that may not be a solution.
No.
But so what's the solution then? And actually, I have two thoughts on this. So one, and then I'll let you pick it up, because you actually, I think, crafted a very nice article, Dave, or actually you did this on your machine because your drive supports this.
Yeah.
But one way to get around this is, so you have something on the DVD drive called firmware, which is kind of like software that tells the hardware how to do its thing. Now, the good news is that there are some people out there who have come up with different firmware that you can flash your drive with. Now, warning, danger, danger to anybody listening. You could potentially destroy your DVD drive by trying to reflash the firmware on there.
That's right.
So this is a risky operation. I mean, you could feign ignorance and say, oh, it doesn't work anymore. And yeah, maybe you get away with it, depending on how honest you sound or look. But
yeah. So I did some digging on a site that you found, John, called forum.rpc1.org. And for my DVD drive, I did find a package of alternate firmware, and I went through, I had to download a little utility, but from my command line, I was able to update the firmware on my DVD drive, and I didn't quite double my ripping speed, but it's, you know, probably a good 80% faster. So it definitely worked. Now, what's interesting about this process is, yes, it's risky. I'm sure I voided whatever warranty I had on the DVD drive there. Although, like you said, good luck figuring out that that's what I did. But in the package, there were four different firmwares. There was the stock firmware. So in case I ever wanted to go back, although John, you're right. We did. Jim and I crafted an article, and it is already up on Mac Observer. So we'll link to that, of course, in the show notes. But the first thing I would recommend doing in this process is making a copy of the firmware that's on your drive. And you can do that with this little command line utility. And then you upload one of these four or one of these three other firmwares that came on the thing. And all of them will remove rip lock limitation. But there are other things that they will do, too, including removing any region encoding changes and anything like that. So, yeah. So if you have reason to change regions all the time, you can also put a firmware on that won't have the drive won't remember that it has changed regions. And so you can do it as many times as you want, presumably. But yeah, the article's up there, and for my, you know, for my drive, which is an OptiArc drive, it seemed to work just fine. So your mileage will almost certainly vary. But yeah, worked great. So interesting.
Back to my earlier point, I do consider riplock a defect in the hardware.
Okay, I see what you say. So you're
seriously, it is. I mean, they're stating, oh, I don't know. We want to make it quiet. No, they're limiting the performance of something where otherwise, you know, I would say it's almost false advertising. So when we looked at the specs on this drive, as we discussed there, no, let me talk.
Okay,
I'm going to talk over you, and then you talk over me.
Okay, no,
but they advertise this as an 8x DVD drive. Okay. 8x to me means 8x. It doesn't mean 8x unless you're playing a movie, in which case it's 2x, which
right.
sounds like that's what they're doing. So,
that's
so
exactly
to me,
right.
I would think you almost have a case that this is false advertising on somebody's part. I'm not sure who.
Yeah, well,
it's limiting or crippling the device to a lower performance standard other than the advertised maximum. And to me, I just think that's wrong.
The thing is, for the most, unless you're ripping these things, you actually want this, because I noticed the sound of things ripping or the drive
spinning. It should be user configurable then. It should not be burned into the firmware. You should be able to say, oh, I would like the drive to run in maximum performance mode, and I'll put up with the noise if it's even an issue, or I would like quiet mode.
Yep.
But at this point, at least in this system configuration, it's not a user choice. So that's why, again, I kind of shake my fist. I'll give you that. They're taking choice away from you.
Absolutely.
They're assuming. And again, I mean, obviously the name of the technology kind of gives away the intent. It's to aggravate people who want to back up their DVDs.
Yeah, and to be fair, I don't. Well, This is not necessarily a choice that Apple has made. It's a choice that the mechanism manufacturers.
Yeah, Apple has no control. Apple buys, I think, the least expensive components when they can.
Absolutely.
And maybe they inadvertently picked one that had this technology. And we're now seeing a groundswell of people that are saying, you know what, this is bogus, man. Because I use my machine for this purpose and it's not cutting the mustard. So
it's true. All right. So we've talked about a lot of tips. We've shared some cool stuff found. We have a couple of questions. There's a couple of things from CES that I saw that I want to wrap up as well. But John, let's tell everyone how to contact us here. So if you have a tip or a question of your own, feedback@macgeekgab.com is the place you email.
It always is. It's always feedback@macgeekgab.com, Dave.
No.
Sometimes it may not be, but well, I'm going to let you tell people about a different way to reach us.
That's right. So you can call us if you like at 206-666-GEEK, which John is
4335.
You can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab. And if you're a premium subscriber, instead of using feedback@macgeekgab.com, you can use premium@macgeekgab.com.
Dave, what is this premium thing of which you speak?
It is an awesome thing. 2 years ago, I think. Yeah, 2 years ago, we started doing a couple extra episodes a month. And those are available to our premium subscribers only. You get 2 extra episodes a month. It is $25 for 6 months of this. In addition to that, you get access to all of the archives as opposed to just the previous, I think, 25 shows. And you get that warm, fuzzy feeling that you get when you support John and I. And we really do appreciate it. It's a fantastic thing. We have a lot of fun with the premium show. We're going to record one this coming Thursday. And we would very much appreciate having you join us over there. If you're not already, if you are already a premium subscriber, thank you. It's awesome. Mm-hmm. We really are humbled.
And what you can do is, so the show notes that I always, of course, lovingly handcraft, you can see the show notes to get a flavor for what's happening on the premium shows. You can go to the show notes and see what we've discussed on the show. And, you know, that'll help you, maybe help your decision about signing up for premium.
There you go.
What else, Dave?
So I said that while I was at CES, there were a couple other things I wanted to talk about. We talked about this company called Liquipel that's offering this nanoparticle waterproofing for your iPhone or other kind of handheld electronics device. There were actually 4 companies at CES that had this, Liquipel obviously being one of them. HZO, who was partnered with Zag on this, was the other one that was getting a lot of press. But there's a couple others, and one of them has already partnered with, I believe they've partnered with Verizon to offer this as an OEM option on the Droid Razor. And it's interesting. The way it works is they take the device, they put it in a vacuum chamber, John. And then when it gets to just the right temperature and lack of pressure, they release these particles in, and it just instantly, you know, fills every nook and cranny. Some of the companies are actually taking the device apart so that it's ensuring it gets all over the circuit boards and everything. Some of them, it's very similar technology, but they each have their nuances. The one from HZO that Zag has partnered with, the one that you might have seen on Good Morning America or whatever, they're using slightly thicker nanoparticles. And so they have, when they do this, they mask off the inside of the headphone jack and also the dock connector, because they say that otherwise it might interfere with the signal.
Well, that's my question, is that you have, all right, so the buttons I can understand, but the connectors, I mean, how are you going to guard against liquid, say you drop it in the toilet or the sink or whatever? How do these prevent you from damaging? Yeah, I mean, from what I recall, most of the latest iDevices have a water detector, at least in the, I think most of them in the headphone jack. Well, it turns red if any moisture detector, gets in there.
The water detector is going to have this stuff all over it. And I saw a demo from one of the companies, right, where they had paper towels, and one of the paper towels was coated with this stuff and the other one wasn't. And the guy put droplets of colored water down onto the paper towels. And of course, one of them was like, you know, Bounty. It just absorbed it entirely. The other one, it beat it up on there, and it was so water repellent that when you took your finger down and touched it to the water droplet actually stuck to your finger and lifted off the paper towel. It just, it would not stick to the paper towel whatsoever. They call it a hydro, God, what do they call it? It was like fear of water. I can't remember what the term was, but it essentially made these things completely repellent of water. And so
hydrophobic.
Thank you. That's it. Really? Of course, that's it. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I don't know why I couldn't think of that. Yeah. Hydrophobic. Yeah. So your little water sensor would be covered with that. And there's no, once it's covered with it, there's no way that it's going to ever turn, because it's, water's never going to touch it. But some of the other ones,
I'm still scratching my head over how you could coat the connectors that require, or do they pass electrical current?
No. So it is a non-conductive material once it has been applied. But for most of these, it is so thin that electric current will pass through.
Oh, okay.
It.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, well, I should probably go to MacObserver.com and read up on these articles.
Yeah,
or contact the vendors. Okay. No, yeah. It has me scratching my head how you could both waterproof something but allow electrical connections to the dock and the headphone, earphone,
right,
jack.
So okay. They all had them. Zag had theirs, you know, they would put headphones in and have it literally playing music from underwater through their headphones. And it worked fine. So, yeah. So it's interesting. My guess is within the next year, we're going to see this on a lot of phones, perhaps even coming to some Apple phones.
Okay.
That would be nice. Yeah. So it's interesting. We did the show Wednesday morning, and I talked about those shark fin things that allowed you to take your existing earbuds and turn them into custom fitted ear molds. Well, then I went and met with a company called Sonomax, Sonomax, and they have something that they're calling ears. And it's very interesting, John. What you do is, and this all, I went through this process shortly after we finished recording the last show. I went into a little room. I sat down. I opened up a box. Inside the box was something that looked like kind of a weird looking set of over the ear headphones. And they had little nubs coming out where your ears were. And so the idea was, you take these things, you put the little nubs in your ears, and you flip a switch on either side, and then you open your mouth and you stop talking for 5 minutes. And these little nubs are then filled with silicone that grows inside your ear, conforms to your ear, and then solidifies. And after 5 minutes is done, you remove this contraption from your head, you pop the little nubs off of this contraption, and now they turn into custom fit earphones that you just made for yourself in 5 minutes. And they sound fantastic. Now, I am a big fan for listening to music. I'm a big fan of dynamic drivers, which would typically be one speaker per ear, as opposed to balanced armatures, which is where you get into multiple drivers per ear. On stage, using in-ear monitors, you know, in that sense, I like the balanced armature. I can get a different EQ pattern for it. But for listening to music, I was a kid that grew up sitting next to the stereo speaker, hearing that sound, hearing the speaker actually move. And so I like dynamic drivers. So I actually went with their cheaper pair, which I believe was retails for $199. You can get a dual driver pair that goes for $299. But I really like these 199s, and they fit really well. I used them on the plane. I'm crazy. We all know this, but I actually keep what's called a seal test MP3 on my iPhone, John. And really all it does is it plays a sound that's down at about 40 hertz to hear if you've got the low end right, because you won't hear that low end that low if your seal in your ear isn't right. And then it also plays a sound up in the, I don't know, about 12 hertz, 12,000. 12 kilohertz rather, to hear if you've got a high end thing. And they work great right out of the gate, 5 minutes. So custom fit earphones in your home, no wait, $200. Sonomax ears. They sound fantastic. So had to talk about those. I thought it was awesome.
Okay.
And lastly, you heard me talk about this when we were doing our favorite cases just before our final show of the year there, John, maybe before our Christmas time show. I did finally get my hands on a Spec Mag Folio for the iPad 2. And this is just like the Fit Folio that I used to use, but now this one uses the magnets in the iPad 2's case, and it opens and close. When you open and close, it turns the thing on and off, and the magnet makes it stick, and it's awesome. It is, for me anyway, absolutely the best case for an iPad in existence. It's really thin, doesn't add a whole lot of bulk to the thing, protects it, allows you to stand it up a couple of different ways, and uses the magnets that are built in, which makes it fun and geeky. So I definitely recommend checking out the Spec Mag Folio. Makes me happy. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. All right. How are we doing on time? Wow. We didn't get to, well, we got to one question. That was good. So, so I guess that's where we go. Do you want to, I'm trying to look at our question here. You know, let's do it. We got a couple of really quick ones here. We'll do Johnny and Tyler because those go pretty quick and they are good questions. So let's see if we can do this. Johnny writes, I've got a problem with a podcast, actually, Mac Geek Gab 220, that I can't seem to get rid of in iTunes. I have a couple of smart playlists for podcasts and Mac Geek Gab, and recently episode 220 started showing up in the list. It has the exclamation point next to it, and iTunes says it can't find the original file. I can't find the original file either. If I delete it from the smart playlist, it comes right back, of course. It does not appear in the podcast section of iTunes. So I seem to be stuck in iTunes. It seems to be stuck in iTunes memory for some reason. How can I get rid of this link to a non-existent file? Okay, so my guess is that it's somewhere in iTunes. It could be, instead of being in the podcast section, it could just be in the music section. So that, if you want to find it, that's where I'd look for it. But the other thing is, smart playlists allow you to delete things. You can, and you got to help me with this, John, here. I think it's holding down the command key when you delete from a smart playlist, and it will delete it entirely from your library. Is that, do you remember that to be correct, John?
I don't use them, so I have no idea.
It's either command or option, but I think it's command. So I'm going to test this here. Because I don't do it all that often.
Well, let's see. Google Foo, deleting items from smart playlist.
Let's see. What do I have that I can delete here? All right. So I have this sound. I'm gonna
shift. Is I'm it gonna, shift? Yeah, it's no, one of those magic keys.
It is. Well, I'm in a smart playlist, and maybe it is shift. Huh. John, I am at a loss. I know I've done this. I'm pretty sure it's the command key, but I don't know why. My iTunes on this computer is kind of foobar because I use it for a very strange purpose. But yeah, it's not letting, maybe I got to hold down command and option and delete. There it is. Okay. So yeah, it's option because command and option when you're deleting it from the list. And it will say, do you want to move the selected song to the trash or keep it in the media folder? And you say move to trash. And there you go. So hold down the option and then hit command delete. And that will remove a track from your smart playlist. And that should do it. Make sense? Works? Good? Yes? Okay. Mm. Good.
Whatever.
I love how you focus only on those things that impact you. As opposed to, our listeners.
It's all about focus. I'm focused on the listeners who are focused on the things I'm focused on. How about that?
That's a good way of putting it. There you go. All right. This one's a pesky thing. So we'll go through this with Tyler. Tyler writes, I'm a recent iOS convert, and I love the iOS experience. I would never turn back to using Android ever again. But my issue is this. Because I was an Android user for almost 3 years, my main email application had become Gmail. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I have two other email addresses that forward to my Gmail account, and I also receive mail directly to the account as well. I have a 2010 MacBook Pro, and I have no issues using the Mail app on my Mac and having it sync with my Gmail and all my labels and archived mail. Where I'm experiencing issues is with my iPhone. Using the Mail app on the iPhone, I have Gmail set up as an Exchange email account, as suggested by Google and Verizon on how to set up Gmail on an iOS device. I have my correct email address and correct username and correct password entered, and the server is set as m.google.com just like it's supposed to be. The Mail app will work correctly on my iPhone for a maximum of 1 day, and then it will go into this cycle of telling me the Exchange account password and ask me, or telling me that the Exchange account password is wrong and ask me to enter the correct password. I type in the correct password, yet it will still state that the password is incorrect. After about 3 to 4 attempts, it will tell me that Mail has experienced an error and Mail can't be received. Do I have something set up incorrectly, or is there something I can do to resolve the issue? So the answer is yes. And I've seen this not only with Gmail set up as Exchange, but also with Gmail set up as IMAP or POP. What has happened is, for whatever reason, Gmail on the server side has decided that you are trying to log in too many times, or you've done something that makes them think that perhaps there was a attempted security breach on your account from an iOS device, and therefore they have locked out access to all iOS devices pending a reset of Gmail's security. And they do that by having you log in and type a CAPTCHA code, right? One of those, you know, prove you're human kind of things. And we've got an article at TMO that we'll put in the show notes that explains exactly how to undo this. And you can even bookmark a link over at Gmail and so that you can do it right from your iPhone. I have it in my bookmarks. I don't have to do it all the time, but my guess is once Tyler goes through this once, it probably won't happen for 6 months or so, but someday it will happen again. And you'll want to have that link bookmarked. And John, now that you're on Gmail with your iPhone, you probably want to bookmark this too, because eventually it happens. I think it's when your phone tries to log in and you lose connectivity because, you know, it's a phone and, you know, sometimes you're in, you know, weird coverage range or whatever. And if you lose connectivity kind of midway through a password negotiation, I think that's what trips this up.
Yeah, I've come across this. I think that come across more often is a lot of times with your iOS device, you have to register with the Google Sync services.
That's for calendars, not so much for Mail.
Okay, all right. When I did calendars, yes, I remember I had to go through a special silly walk to get the calendars to show up on my my iOS device.
You know, that's another good. Fine. That's another good tip. If you set up, if you're sharing calendars or using Google to sync calendars, when you configure it on your iOS device, by default, you will only see your main single calendar from Google on your device. But all hope is not lost. You can get that back. But what you have to do, and you have to do this from one of your iOS devices. So if you've got an iPad, this is the time to use it because it's a much bigger screen. But go to m.google in your browser. This is in Safari. You're going to go to m.google.com/sync, S-Y-N-C. Log into your Google account, and then it'll show you a list of your devices, your iOS devices that are attached to that account, and pick one. And then you can go through and tell it which calendars should show up on that device. You have to do it for each device. And here's the great thing. There's no way to remove a device. So I have, I don't know, I've got like six devices listed.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, none of the other ones are attached anymore, but I can't get them out of there. So, yeah, this is what it is. But, you can go through. It tells you when they last synced, so you got an idea of which one. If you have multiples that you've used with it over the years, you can figure out which ones, you know, the active ones.
All right. So I'll find the help article because, when I first did Google Calendar, I was like, wow, this is great. And then I'm like, well, why isn't it on my device?
Not that great. That's right.
And that's the answer. Yeah. There's the band thawing out.
It's not that cold today. It's almost right. It's darn near 40 today. All right.
Well, hopefully it's going to be warming up once we travel, Dave, which is in about a week. I think a week from today.
Yeah, I'm actually
flying on a plane.
Yeah, I'm flying out a week from yesterday. That's right.
Oh, you're flying out, and I'm flying out Tuesday, and then we got this Macworld vertical bar iWorld thing.
That's right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We should have a good time out there. It's going to be a lot of fun. Do we need to talk about where we're going to be during Macworld iWorld Expo? I think we did that, right? But we can talk about it again. So if you're coming out,
Get my calendar.
All right, so Thursday morning at 11 a.m., I will be doing my backing up your Mac session as a tech talk, and that's available to anyone that has the iFan pass, which this year is cheap. It used to be like $300 to get a user conference pass. It's essentially the same thing now, and you get it for like less than $100. So that's actually pretty cool. So I'm looking forward to that.
When Thursday?
Thursday at 11, and then Thursday at 2 o'clock, John. You and I are going to be at the Smile booth, and this is
awesome. It was three. Are you sure it's two? I thought it was three.
No, you're right. Yes, you're right. Sorry, I have a meeting at the Smile booth at two. Sorry. Show up at three. Thank you, John. Yep. So show up at 3 p.m. at the Smile booth, and John and I will be there for an hour, and this is awesome. I'm so glad we're doing it because, you know, we do our sessions and our Mac Geek Gab, which we'll tell you about, but the problem is, you know, those rooms are always booked or the stages are always booked or wherever we are, and so we don't have time to, like, stand and chit-chat. Well, for an hour, we are chained to the Smile booth. And so we have nothing but time to chit chat, and that is why we're there. So come on to the Smile booth. And
but it's not only us, Dave. Chit-chat. If we can mention some of the, you know, the other people that do this podcast thing. But not only will we be there, but after us will be our friend Adam from the MacCast, and then
that's right.
For an hour, and then after that will be Katie and David from Mac Power Users. So.
That's right.
If you want to meet the Mac podcasters, I would say between the three of us, that's really all you need to. That's all you need to listen to, right?
That's awesome. So that's 3 to 4. Then at 5 o'clock, there's something called Macworld Rapid Fire, which is happening in room 2006 upstairs in the West Hall. It's going to last about an hour and a half. There's, I think, 15 of us doing little 5-minute snippets, training. Tidbits, whatever it is, and each one of us is just going to be back to back, no break in between. We're just going to blaze on through, and so that should be a lot of fun. That'll be kind of crazy, but that should be fun. And then on Friday, let's see, I'm going to do this slightly out of order. At 2 p.m. on Friday afternoon, Mac Geek Gab Live. My guess is that that's going to be Mac Geek Gab 377, but it might be Mac Geek Gab 378 if John and I squeeze one in once we get on the ground in San Francisco.
We could try. Of course, before that, let's see, 10 a.m.
That's right. Yep.
The Mac Roundtable, which is all of your favorite Mac podcasters, including Dave and I and some of the people I mentioned, and even more, which I'm not sure what the heck we're going to talk about. But
yeah. So, yeah, that's right. Mac Geek Gab on the show floor will be cool stuff found, of course, that we found at the show. And then we'll also do Stump the Geek. So bring your questions and see what you can do.
And then, you know, that I hear there's a pretty cool party that evening, Dave.
That's right. Cirque du Mac 9 is happening Friday night at 8 o'clock. Can't guarantee tickets for everyone, but if you ask, you might just get tickets. And if you come to the podcast or my talk or whatever, I will have paper tickets. John will have paper tickets in hand. So you can email us to try and get on the guest list. No promises, but we'll see what we can do. And if you come and meet us and we have paper tickets in hand, that's a great way to get some of them. So come and ask us a question. Anybody asking a question at doing a Stump the Geek thing, we'll definitely earn a pair of tickets. I think that's a given. So... yeah, that's Macworld Expo. So I want to say thank you to Michael Johnston of the We Have Communicators podcast. He converts this into AAC with all those chapters and pictures and all that for us and for you. Cashfly at CACHEFLY.com provides all the bandwidth for this podcast for us and for you. And the podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers and the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, Text Expander from Smile, and Gazelle, where you can get all of your, you can sell all of your extra electronics. And all of that is through Backbeat Media Podcast Network. John, that is it for this week's show number 375. We will be doing premium show 376 on Thursday. If you're not already a premium member, come join us over there. We'd love to see you. Until then, have fun,